So where should we go back to?
It's Ellis Island Oral History Project, Jan Bocconi, tape number 5. And we were talking about you joining with one man as you circled
around. Yes, I started to walk with him. And then I soon realized what was going on. Some people have been there for weeks on end, and some people were there just a day or two, and some a week or two. They all had different experiences, but it was a tremendous source of information and also a source of rumors. I mean, it was a rumor factory, and you couldn't get a straight, reliable answer. You sort of had to judge from the advice you would get of how to behave and what to do. And this all comes from the fact that we were in being dealt with by the U.S. Immigration Office, which is not the State Department. It's an independent agency. They had their rules, and nobody really quite understood what those rules were. They were not, as I said, they were not in unison with the policies of the State Department or many other. They were, in other words, they didn't catch up, or their rules or their instructions were not synchronized. And so we soon learned that what these people go by was what was written by the book. They were going exactly by the law and what was written in the book. And each one of us had a much more complicated situation. I was coming on a student visa. And I was given to understand by those who were advising me that if I'm going to be, I knew I will have to go before a hearing to establish my case, to see what has to be done, if what they can do, or what they will do. And so I looked forward to this hearing, uneasily forward. And they told me, you have to tell them when they will ask if you can go back. You have to say yes, because you have a student visa that's limited for 1 year, and after that's over, you're going back. And if you say otherwise, you won't get in. And of course, it wasn't true. I wasn't going to go back. And normally, if I wouldn't have been warned, they say, "Can you go back?" I would have probably said no. So that was the one thing that became very clear to me, that I better say that, because everybody was telling me that's what I have to do. Well, I wasn't called the first day. My case was to be next day. So that meant I would have to stay overnight.
Let me ask you before you go on, how did you find someone to speak a language?
Was an international way. Nobody spoke Czech to me. I don't remember if I talked German to somebody. There were a lot of Jewish people there that spoke many languages. I can speak French. I might have been speaking French. Anyway, I don't remember that. It's hard for me to imagine that there was a time when I didn't speak English, you see. It's obvious. But there were no Czechs there. I remember that much. I wasn't speaking my native language.
You could have been speaking French, German, Swedish?
A little bit of Swedish, but I don't think I spoke to with anybody Swedish. The Swedish had the least reason to be there. There would have been very few immigrants from Sweden at that point.
How many languages you spoke?
I spoke, those are the two languages, three languages, Czech, German, French, that I could speak well, and the little Swedish. Czech was definitely not what I was speaking in Ellis Island. Anyway, so then we fell into the pattern of living on Ellis Island, which was probably what you would want to know, what I remember about it. I remember that we were eating in mess halls that were not so terribly large, not as big as, it was a limited-sized room with long tables and long benches. And it was just like in the army. I mean, they were ladling out the food over our shoulders, from big pots, and they were carrying these big pots around the table. And the food was hearty and adequate. It wasn't terrific, but it was plenty. And at night, we were staying in what you might call a kind of combination dormitories, or more like a hospital ward for 18, 20 people in one room with barred windows, which could have been a psychiatric ward somewhere. And the walls tiled with white tile, and the floor of white tile, and the beds were iron beds, but good ones, and mattresses were fine. But it was locked, and once we were in the room, we were locked up. So it was kind of a combination hospital prison or psychiatric ward, something of that sort. And when we want to go to the jail or to wash up, we went in groups with a guard, always with a guard, who went with us to the jail and to constant guards. Guards were all over the place. They had blue uniforms. They were friendly but non-committal. They were bored with their job, but they were doing it punctiliously. And so that gave us a feeling of lack of freedom, obviously. We were being guarded. And we were taken for exercise to the outdoors. And there was the strange situation where I remember very vividly going into this space, which wasn't a yard because it was against the building, it was outside between the water and the building. And it was surrounded, it was enclosed by on two sides by the building and on two sides by a chain-link fence with a barbed wire around it on the tops. It's like a prison yard, but with a view. And the view was the Statue of Liberty. So I was looking at the Statue of Liberty through a chain-linked fence and crossed with barbed wire. It was a kind of a strange experience. That I will never forget either. And then I finally got to the hearing. I think it's probably the second day. And I was they told me what the matter was. And I had a passport that had a proper student visa in it, but it was only valid for half a year. Now, the consulate general in Stockholm has never found it, or maybe he found it but didn't want to bother because it would have caused difficulties. So he overlooked it. It could be either that he overlooked it or he didn't know about it. Nevertheless, the immigration officials found out, established it right away, already on a boat, that there was a discrepancy between the length of the visa and the length of the validity of the passport. So on that basis, they couldn't let me in. And so then the question got to be, how is it going to be solved? And my friend was called into the meeting, and he said, I'm going to have the passport extended if you permit that. And they said, sure, how are you going to do it? Well, there is a government in exile office in New York, and I think they will, he called them up. They said, yes, we'll extend it. So he took the passport to that office. Czechoslovak government in exile had a kind of consulate here.
Where?
In New York. In
the address?
It was somewhere near Columbus Circle, but I didn't go there myself. And they extended my passport. He took it back, and the case was solved. But they did ask me, if you wanted to, can you go back? And I said, yes. I lied. But it was a necessary lie, it was a white lie. And they did it. They probably knew exactly what I was doing, but they simply had to go by the book. So when that was over, then it was only a matter of when the passport came back and they saw it and they okayed it, then I could leave. So on the way back to the mainland, I was going on a ferry boat. There was a small ferry boat that was going to Battery Park between Arizona and Battery Park. So I went on that ferry. Those are the pictures here in the book. And that's my story. But then from there, my friend took me straight to Columbia. And I arrived at Columbia that same morning on the 7th of February, and I registered, and I stayed there for, and the dean of the school put me into the second year of School of Architecture. Here I was an architect, a graduated architect, put me into the second year, and he explained to me why he was doing it, and he was absolutely right. He said, you are going to learn English, and you're going to best learn it if you deal with a subject you know, and that's the way you learn from your other fellow students and from the professors. They were wonderful to me. The faculty was unbelievably. They have, since I couldn't speak at the beginning at all, they all spoke French to me, because they were all graduates of the Beaux-Arts School in Paris, and they loved to speak French. It reminded them of their youth, so I came along wonderfully. The other thing that I wanted to say, but it was a nice coincidence, that the Ellis Island main building was built, designed by William Boring, who used to be the dean of the School of Architecture at Columbia. So the dean built the building. I spent my first day in America, my first few days in America. Well, I'm still at Columbia. I started as a professor. No, I started as a student, and then became an assistant, and so on. And so I got to be a full professor. Now I'm a professor emeritus, but I still teach. So it's now 48 years that I've been at Columbia, from 1940 until 1948. Almost exactly 48 years, because February 8th is going to be 7th. Going to be in a few days, in a month.
Perhaps as we get near the end of our interview, you could tell us a little bit about your observations about coming into the United States and architectural studies here compared with architectural studies in Europe at the period.
Well, it was quite different. I told you that the system here in the United States was based on the Beaux-Arts, although Columbia wasn't per se following the exact curriculum. It was sort of trying to combine the two systems. There was more technical instruction at Columbia than in most other schools in the United States. That's what made it one of the best schools in the United States at the time. And I learned a great deal from the professors who went through the Beaux-Arts system, which I didn't know from Czechoslovakia, was much more pragmatic. But this Beaux-Arts system was a system of teaching design in a very special, very useful way. Useful in a general way, in general terms, not that it meant a special style, although it did at the time when it was taught in Paris. The same method applied to modern architecture is as valid as any other system might be. So that I've learned from these Beaux-Arts teachers. I remember particularly Professor Fletcher, who was a typical Beaux-Arts teacher, and all the others too. I've also been able to contribute something. I was a relatively good draftsman. I had a fine hand, and I had no equipment with me. I brought only the bare necessities, certainly no architectural tools. I didn't have a compass, I didn't have any triangles, I just had a few mechanical pencils. So, I didn't want to invest too much money, I didn't have much money. So, everything at the School of Architecture here was, when they came to the final stage of a project, was done in ink. Everything was drawn in ink. And this is what I didn't want to do. I wanted to do it in pencil. So I did all my rendering, my final presentation drawings in pencil. But they were so good that it started a precedent, which they probably weren't very happy about, because when the students saw that this can be done, they all started doing it, and ink disappeared in about a year. And that was my contribution to the school. You could call it a negative contribution from their point of view. But I had a good time there. And in fact, I must say that Columbia really put me on my feet here. I got a master's degree there, and that was the basis of my whole career. But now I'm very much involved with the Czechoslovaks again. I am the chairman of the American Fund for Czech Refugees, and we admitted about 444, we have relocated about 444 people last year in this country. And in total, we must have dealt with about 150,000 Czechoslovaks over the years, in the last 40 years. And I'm also involved with the Bohemian Benevolent and Literary Association, which is a building on 73rd Street, and I'm redesigning it. And so I'm back in the Czech, American Czech life.
That brings us to the end, I think, of our interview, tape number five, unless there's something you think we should, in addition, we should talk about.
I think so. I think.